The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance political journalist Marie Leconte.
This week we are joined by Labour MP for Birmingham Yardley, Jess Phillips. Hello, Jess.
Hello.
Jess is chair of the Women's Parliamentary Labour Party and author of Every Woman, One Woman's Truth About Speaking the Truth, available from all good Amazons. And we'll be giving away copies of your book later. But thank you for coming in to Delta Poll Towers. I know you've been very impressed by the surroundings so far.
It's interesting. It's very trendy.
Yes, thank you. We all enjoy it very, very much. So, in the news this week then, shall we kick off with the Brexit bonanza and funding to the NHS? Mm-hmm. 85% of people are concerned about the levels of NHS funding. Two-thirds support a 1% increase in income tax for the NHS. These numbers have come around very often about mm-hmm. the debate. But we find ourselves now with money from Brexit, apparently. Mm-hmm. Does anyone believe that?
I've not met anyone yet who believed that. I think most people, the average people, don't give a toss where the money comes from as long as the NHS is getting money. And I think it is a bit of a Westminster row, if I'm honest, because anybody at any moment could have a row about Brexit. I think it is a lie, of course, that it's coming from Brexit. How could it possibly be coming from Brexit?
Do you think there's a danger that actually everything now that is discussed in Parliament will be just traced back to Brexit, one way or another?
Yes, no doubt the sexual harassment that goes on in there is Brexit's fault, and Speaker Burko and his time limits, no doubt that's Brexit's fault. Everything is Brexit. It is a black hole.
And I have nothing to add. I just, I've just been asleep for the past 2 minutes. I just hear the word Brexit and, I just go to my happy place.
But we also mentioned the word NHS, which is, of course, the closest we have in this country to a religion. So that's meant to get everyone excited. Labour are 13 points ahead on the issue. They've always been ahead. Do you think they're ever in danger of getting caught by the Tories? Is there anything the Tories can do to convince the public?
No. I mean, they could, run the NHS well for a long period of time, and then they would probably gain some trust. But no, all my life they've been trying to dismantle it, and people have noticed. So no, I don't think there's anything the Tories could do to beat the Labour Party on the NHS.
And how do you think the latest developments on cannabis oil and its availability will affect people's views of healthcare in this country, if at all?
I think that people think that we should have cannabis oil available to people if they're ill. I think I've not heard a single dissenting voice, actually, that thinks that kids with epilepsy shouldn't be able to have the medicine that works.
But I think what I found interesting with this is that Sajid, I think very much the same way that when Michael Gove came in at DEFRA, everyone kind of went, oh, actually turns out you can do stuff at DEFRA, because obviously after Andrew Letsam, who'd not done much. And I feel like Sajid's already, because, I think when Amber Rudd was Home Secretary, there was kind of the assumption that because it was Theresa May's old gig, then she can really do anything. And I feel like, I think Sajid is going to be fascinating to watch, because he's made the headlines several times. He's, I think, changed Number 10's mind on several issues already. So, yeah, it will be interesting to see what
happens. He's going to be the next leader of the Tory party. And the next Prime Minister, I wager. I put money on him ages ago, so I've really been talking him up.
You put money. Who did you put money on with? Just doesn't matter. But other bookmakers are available. The Guardian has described cannabis oil as the crack cocaine of skunk. Speaking of dissenting voices, I assume that was a dissenting voice. It might have actually been a plus.
The Guardian.
The Guardian described it as the crack cocaine of skunk. Those are three words I just don't understand.
The Guardian don't know what the bloody hell they're talking about, clearly. I mean, honestly, nobody minds people taking morphine and, you know, nobody also suggesting...
Well, I think recreationally there are questions about whether people should take
morphine. We're not suggesting people should take cannabis oil recreationally, although now The Guardian seems to be advertising it to a certain market. Who knew that that was the case?
I don't know, only people on the dark web, I assume. who knows? And Marie was kind enough to point out earlier, reports come in that Theresa May has confirmed she has never taken cannabis.
What a surprise, yes. Generally. Yeah, so, yeah.
Exactly.
Wasn't a field of weed.
No, that would have been...
That would have been a real shocker if she'd just been like, yeah, I just like to, you know, skin up a Philly blunt every night with...
with Phil.
With Phil, me and Phil. We like to relax.
If she turned around and said, no, I've never taken cannabis because of all the massive acid trips that I've been on, that prevented me from ever getting close to it. And it just takes the edge off the crack come down. All that would have been... it would have been interesting, but...
It might help her out, relax her a bit.
I would have actually quite liked that, the idea of being like, yeah, actually, you know, massive stoner. And it's like, I reckon that would have worked out well for her in the polls.
I would argue probably not among her core support, but you never...
Cameron admitted to being a massive stoner, or there was just some pictures of him with a spliff.
Yeah. No, I think there were definitely stories about him smoking quite a lot when he was at university, and I didn't think that did him a lot of harm.
But it turns out that he might have done worse things while at university.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
You know, these things are all relative. This week, we also had the announcement that David Dimbleby will be leaving Question Time. Jess, you've been on Question Time.
I have.
What's it like, and what is the Dimbleby like as a host?
I have a couple of David Dimbleby-related anecdotes that I think I might save till he's definitely not going to be chairing any session that I'm on. When's he actually leaving?
Not sure.
Oh, end of the year, I think.
I was one time before I went on Question Time. I like to just, you know, brush up on exactly the details of what the customs union is.
Quick bit with the crack cocaine of skunk.
Indeed. And the single market. One of the researchers said to me, oh, yeah, David needs explaining to him every time we come on. And you get this realisation that this man you thought knew everything and could catch you out at any minute has to go on Wikipedia to look up the customs union as well.
He and, I think, approximately 58 million people
in Britain. Indeed. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's probably time that he went. I think he's been good at it, although... You know, it is a bit old guard, isn't it, these days, Question Time? It can seem a bit old guard.
So there was this amusing anecdote from, I can't remember who it was on Twitter, but a few days ago, saying that actually part of the reason why the format of Question Time is now so bad is because of the expenses scandal, where effectively the first few Question Times after, like, while that was happening, obviously ended up kind of being, like, the public entirely furious at the MPs on the panel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then that did really well. So the producers kind of decided to recreate that kind of, that wall of anger in front of the MPs, you know, as a kind of like weekly thing, because that worked really well. And so, you know, and I think obviously it's not really been working that well, because I think if you just have that every single week, it just ends up being absolutely tiring and just not very interesting.
Do you watch every week?
I don't watch ever, I'm afraid to say. It's on quite late, and I sound like an old lady. I watch it if I remember, but I wouldn't say I watch it religiously, and I used to watch it absolutely religiously before I was elected. Absolutely religiously.
Oh, that's interesting. So once you were on the inside, you just thought, I can't be bothered.
Well, it's like when I worked in domestic violence services, people would be like, oh, did you see that documentary about domestic violence? And I was like, no, I watch The Bake Off because I do that all day at work. I want whimsy at the weekends. So I tend, to watch Love Island. So, yeah, I don't watch it very often. And I think it's a bit shouty.
Do you think that the BBC should try and carry on with the same sort of format, or should they get a new presenter and use that as an opportunity to really shake it up? Because if you look at who are the bookmaker's favourite, Kirsty Walker is number one. So she's top favourite at the moment, and I would say she's very much in the sort of continuation of David Dimbleby mould. Whereas at number three, you've got Emma Barnett, who I think would be great, but would not fit the same mould.
And I agree, as like you've basically stolen my thing, where I was about to jump in and go, I really hope Emma Barnett gets it, because she's really great, and I think, you know, she can give a proper roasting to politicians, but in a way that's quite distinctive and not full on, like, you know, the way Dimbleby does it or whoever else. I'm not sure they're going to change the format, which I think is a bit silly, because, you know, as Jess said, like, I didn't really watch it anymore either. But then, so I did Question Time Extra Time a few months ago, which is for the super fans who basically want more Question Time after Question Time, so people I will never understand. And it was quite interesting chatting to them, like the people on the panel. We had super fans on the panel and people who called into the show. And basically the thing they liked specifically about Question Time was how shouty it was.
Yeah, maybe.
So actually I think the general public do enjoy that, which I don't want to criticise the general public. However, weird choices.
Well, speaking of weird choices, joint number four is Matthew Wright at 10-1. I think that would be
that would be a major
departure. Various people would have things to say about that, I imagine.
Yeah, he's just quit his other job, isn't it? He's going begging. Yeah. So.
Well, Arsene Wenger's just quit his job. I don't think they've... maybe they have. I've only got the first...
Arsene Wenger talking Brexit with Jacob Rees-Mogg. I think people would tune in.
Yeah, they probably would. Who would be your choice, then? Marie, if you're going for Emma, who would be your choice?
Well, obviously, I'd like it to be a woman. I think Emma would be absolutely brilliant, and I think she would change it. I think Emily Maitlis would be good.
Yeah, she's second favourite, 5-1.
And I mean, I really like Kirsty. I think that it will change. But one thing I would say that Dimbleby does do really well when you are there, and I've been an audience member as well, and I remember feeling this from him in the chair, was that he makes it about the people in the audience much more so. He comes out and gives you a pep talk and says, this is for you, this is your show, it's not about the people on the panel, it's about you. And I think that being lost would be a shame, and so I hope they keep that element. But I don't see how you can change it, really. It is just people on the panel talking and audience participation. I'm not sure.
But surely it's about who they pick and like which questions. So I'm guessing, don't they? I think people have to send questions in advance.
They do, yeah.
Yeah. So I think maybe picking different kinds of people, because I think there's the issue now also of like parties just having like plonks effectively, you know, and kind of asking that hyper-partisan, really angry question. So, I don't know, maybe, pick less angry people? Medium angry.
They don't let you do it in your hometown, you know, because they asked me recently to do it in Birmingham and then they pulled me at the last minute and like, we can't possibly let you do it in Birmingham. Your entire family will just come along and all your mates. And I was like, that's right, we're all coming.
Would that genuinely have happened?
Or definitely. They would have been like cheering for me, like, woo!
Just booing harder than everyone else.
I was going to say, I'd like to ask Jess why she hasn't bought me a Christmas card for the last 6 years, despite me being very nice to her children whenever we have dinner. What I think they should do is I think they should vote off one of the panellists every week and everyone comes back the next week.
Make them pair up and sleep in a bed together like in Love Island. That would be amazing.
Why has nobody thought of that?
That would be amazing.
Love Question Time.
Oh,
Island.
Gosh. It would be amazing. And you'd get like really unlikely combinations like Matt Zarb Cousins and Melanie Phillips.
I don't think unlikely is a strong enough term for that combination. My goodness. Yeah, why has nobody thought of this? As with so many things on this podcast, if that then does get turned into a TV show, I think we have first rights on on royalties. So there we go.
Producer Nick here with a brief break in the festivities. I'm joined now down the line by Matthew Shaddick from Ladbrokes to talk through a few of those Question Time runners and riders. So Kirsty Walker is a pretty strong favourite at the moment. Are a lot of people backing her for the job?
A few, actually. She's not the most popular person on the list at the moment. In fact, the most bets we've taken has been on Emma Barnett. She was, I think, 12-1 when we first released the mod. She's 8-1 now. Yeah, it's been interesting. Although the women are dominating the list, there has been a bit of money on a couple of male possibilities, including Matthew Wright, 33-1 into 10-1.
Now, that Matthew Wright surge is on the back of a kind of BuzzFeed tip there, but he seems a kind of unlikely presenter. Are there any of the kind of the old guard men who are actually making any sort of movement? I'm thinking Andrew Neil, Paxman, Hugh Edwards, who's sort of been waiting for the job.
Well, of the ones you mentioned there, yeah, Andrew Neil has been a bit of money on him. And, I could see he'd do a pretty good job, but I can also see the other side where there's going to be a lot of outrage. I mean, his actual personal political preferences are quite well known, and although I think he does a great job of putting those to one side when he's interviewing people, I can just see it's going to create a lot of headaches for the BBC should they appoint him. So pretty relaxed about his prices at the moment.
But then again, David Dimbleby was in the Bullingdon Club at Oxford. I think his political preferences, maybe he's better at keeping them under the surface. Is there a sense that it is going to be a woman this time?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, most of the people at the top of the betting are female. And I guess if the producers want to give it a bit of a shake-up and a fresh start, then that's one obvious way of doing it. Yeah, I personally would be quite surprised if he does end up being a man, based on the betting we've seen so far. I don't know what the percentage is, but I'd say about 80% of the bets we've taken have been on female candidates.
And down the bottom end of the market, I see you've priced Nigel Farage at 500-1. He's a BBC favourite. I'm surprised he's not a bit high.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know what the stats are. He's been on the show quite a lot of times, hasn't he? Actually, of some of the really big outsiders, Nicky Campbell, we've introduced him into the betting. A few people have backed him today. I mean, he's only 16-1, but there's one to keep an eye on.
Thanks, Matthew. And you can get that whole market on Ladbrokes.com. Now back to the guys in the studio.
Let's talk now about the issue of upskirting that came up last week. Christopher Chope voted against various things in his time, objected to it. Although he now comes out and says he's not in favour of upskirting, and he was just objecting to the process that it was going through. Now we do have data on this. 96% of people say that they do think taking a picture up a woman's skirt without their permission is sexual harassment, which leads to the immediate question, what do the other 4% think? Do they think that's just fine? It's also the same figure for the number of people that think that a man exposing their genitals to a woman is sexual harassment. Again, the 4% of people who think...
Just not sure.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it's artistic expression, cultural demonstrations.
I think that they're on the crack cocaine of skunks, those, that 4% of
or is it the skunk of crack cocaine? That's the question. I mean, you should never do this as a researcher, but looking at the very small subsamples and very small figures, it is possible to establish that 1% of Labour voters from 2017 say it's never sexual harassment to expose your genitals to a woman without permission. I think that is a stunning statistic. It's never, there are no circumstances in which showing your genitals to someone would be anything other than, I don't know, politeness.
I'd love to meet those people and just, yeah, run
would
through
you
a list.
Would you love to meet them? Really?
They would run through a list of all the scenarios and is. Just, you know, behind a glass wall and just, you know, run through possible situations. Be like, still no, still not sexual. Okay, no, cool. How about that one?
At the other end of the scale, 1% of Labour voters, and there's something about 1% of Labour voters from 2017.
Where has this poll come from?
It's all from my former colleagues at YouGov, so accurate, but not as reasonably priced as Delta poll. 1% of Labour voters also think it's always sexual harassment for a man to ask a woman out for a drink. I'm assuming it's not the same people who think
that was me who
asked
that.
Who think it's definitely sexual harassment. But if only I'd shown her my genitals, then perhaps
that
we would
was
have.
Fine.
Yeah, but anyway, what's now happening with upskirting, Jess?
So the government are going to bring forward a bill to get it through. I'm not sure how quickly that bill will come, but pretty quick. Which is funny because the government cries all the time about how it has no time because of Brexit taking up everything and isn't bringing a million of the bills that it said it was going to, but can find the time for that one because they got a bit of a bad reputation because one of their old boys was a bit of a rotter, and suddenly they can find the time. They haven't found the time for the domestic abuse bill, they haven't found the time for the courts and prison bill, but I shall welcome the upskirting bill nonetheless when it comes, and no doubt there'll be some amendments to it that people will try and make because no domestic legislation comes before us. So it's too delicious an opportunity to miss.
What kind of amendments do you foresee?
Well, there's all sorts of other things that are wrong with the Sexual Offences Act. There's certainly problems around misogyny being a hate crime. It currently isn't classified as a hate crime. And so anyone can be misogynistic to you in public and there would be no crime that had been committed. Whereas if you were racist, that would be considered a crime. So I imagine there'll be campaigns around some of those things.
But I think it's slightly tangential, but what I've kind of enjoyed seeing with the upskirting debate, and I think which has been happening for the past few months, is kind of Tory MPs, you know, taking to their private WhatsApp groups, which will definitely not get leaked, to say, I cannot believe, you know, someone from my own party would do this, you know, I'm outraged and, you know, this should never have happened. And they keep doing this. And I think Conservative MPs, a lot more so than Labour MPs, are just posting stuff that's effectively, if it just been given as a line to a journalist, the journalist would have gone, this is boring, we're probably not going to publish that. But because it was leaked from a private WhatsApp group of Tory MPs, so then all of that gets published. And it's basically a press release.
I absolutely love the WhatsApp chats. I really like the occasional person who hasn't kept up with the thread, like Nadine Dorries will come in and say, you know, what time's this vote or something. I just find it really charming.
What disappoints me is there aren't enough sort of just stupid messages about cat tweets and things like that.
I beg to differ. I'm on plenty of political WhatsApp groups that have stupid messages in them.
Okay, well, in that case, they don't get leaked, which I think is very, very
disappointing. That's what I want. I don't care about the serious stuff. I want to see the memes. I want the memes.
Who's a top WhatsApper, Jess?
Well, my main WhatsApp sort of group in my phone at the moment is the one with Stella Creasy and Lucy Powell, where it started originally talking about Love Island last time. It's called Trash TV, and Lucy is the whip on that, and she tells us how we have to vote. And Stella the other day was like, I'm at a meeting in my constituency, and Lucy was like, I don't care, it takes 2 seconds to vote, and was really like really strict with her.
And has been going on for a year.
This is a year. Oh, wow. But in the meantime, when Love Island wasn't on, we did discussed lots of very serious political things and actually took some actions that have changed laws from that WhatsApp group. And I actually think that there is something to be said about feminist organising and WhatsApp being enabling a space for people to speak and organise things in a way that was really used to be hard when you had to do it physically because people would see you and etc. etc. So it's really brilliant for politics, WhatsApp.
What do you think of the civil servant who's appeared in Love Island? And we're not going to talk about Love Island every week because that's obviously reserved for Brexit. But what do you think?
I mean, I feel absolutely thrilled. I feel a little bit of me is there because somebody who works in a similar building to me is there. And I have probably written parliamentary questions that she's written the answers to. I mean, deeply thrilled. And Lucy Powell puts in like 100 education questions like every day. And she was just so thrilled that they had been being answered by somebody from Love Island.
I'm actually really cross. I feel like...
Controversial.
Yes. No, I don't... I refuse. I feel like if you're going to work in or around politics, you're only allowed to be like medium hot at best. Like, this is not... The very hot people do not belong in Westminster. So she can either do Love Island with the hot people or she can be with us, but she's going to have to pick a side.
She's going to have to pick. And somebody was saying to me who works in Parliament that their wife had been going, oh, do you know this woman? Watching like, oh, you never told me about this one. It's like, you know, 6,000 people who work in that building. I haven't met them all. Oh, you never mentioned this one. And then I just imagined for a second what Damien Hines' wife thinks. Oh, you've not mentioned this Zara. She's attractive.
Does she always wear a bikini to work? No. Only on Thursdays. And she apparently she didn't tell the civil service.
I know, yeah, that's what I heard. Yeah.
I don't know what the rules about that are. I mean, it would strike me as slightly unfair to sack somebody for
appearing on Love Island. You can go on holiday. She's not like on Labour Love Island. No, she's still politically restricted.
But when I go on holiday, it's very unusual for my sex scenes to be televised.
But not.
One time.
Yeah, well, you know, CCTV is a difficult thing.
But yeah, I don't think they should sack her. I think they should embrace it. It's like the most trendy thing that anyone in politics has done ever.
She could be a poster girl for the civil service.
Absolutely.
Come on our fast track. look where you might end up. Majorca. We've talked about the positive side of WhatsApp, but obviously there's a downside. Downside. Jess, you've written and spoken extensively about the dark side of social media, whether it's private communications such as WhatsApp, public communications such as Twitter. If you could wave your magic wand and change anything about social media, how would you change it?
Oh man, I'd make a little picture of everybody's mum flash up before they sent a tweet, just to make sure that they really meant it. I do think that something has to be done about anonymity online. So today I've seen tweets sent to MPs, mainly Tory MPs, that say any MP that blocks Brexit this week runs the risk of being Joe Cox Mark II. And that person, nothing will happen to them. That is the problem for me, is that nothing will happen. And, you know, millions of pounds then get spent on security and things. This isn't a victimless crime. It is very, very real, and it is affecting our democracy. So I think that something needs to be done about the anonymity. I'm not sure what, though, because I'm not a big fan of the idea of the state keeping our data and then using it somehow. I just don't know that I might trust the UK government to do that. Well, maybe not, but you know, I certainly wouldn't trust some states to hold that sort of power over their people. So, but I do feel that somebody should know. So it's all right if you appear online anonymously. I don't care if you want to be called, you know, Big Cat 27. But the people should know who you are.
I don't know how you arrived at Big Cat 27.
Which is what I will call you for the rest of
I once made up like a troll's name in a newspaper article that I wrote, and then loads of parody accounts started with that name.
Marie, you've written extensively about people's internet history and the impact this can have on their lives and their experience. How do you think anonymity fits into that?
That's quite a good question. So I don't know, I feel like the internet has changed actually over the past few years. What I remember quite early on when I had like blogs and I was on MySpace and everything, it was very much a culture where everyone was actually anonymous on social media. And on blogs and kind of, I guess, proto-social media. But it's just been over the past few years, I think, with Facebook and with Twitter and with, you know, some other things where it's become more common for people to have their kind of like name, which is why then I think it does create a bit of a dichotomy where the people who choose to remain anonymous most of the time, you know, do so for basically like bad, you know, like for bad reasons. And I'm not entirely sure. I feel like, you know, there needs to be a cultural change, but I'm not entirely sure how we can make it happen. Because I think that even if we stop people from being anonymous on social media, the line I think is blurry as to, because even, you know, I think even people just calling politicians scum on the internet is an issue, but you know, should they go for prison for that or whatever? I don't think
they should.
But is the issue of how do we tell people that online is still basically real life? Like you can't just act the way you want on social media and feel that, you know, those people are not going to read that or not going to sort of like, it's not going to do anything to them, because that's clearly not the case.
Do you think the genie is out of the bottle now? Is there anything we can actually do to address this, or are we actually stuck with the online world that we have created?
I wonder what's going to happen to Twitter actually in the next few years, because I think a lot, even just looking back at sort of like 3-4 years ago, like in the past 3 or 4 years, so many of my friends and people I know have either stopped using Twitter entirely, or, you know, barely use it, or just use it but only see the notifications from people they follow, etc. And I think, you know, that keeps happening, and I reckon that's going to be interesting going forward. Like if Twitter stops being a thing, I'm not sure what's going to happen actually to politics and journalism, because it's become so embedded in the kind of like daily Westminster grind. And I think that's going to be fascinating to watch if Twitter does either shut down or people decide to leave it.
Do you think there's always a space in the market for that? Now there's always a space in the market for that sort of app or program, however you want to characterize it, because of the way that politics has now evolved.
Yeah, I think I would find it incredibly difficult if I didn't feel that I could be responsive and reactive to things that are happening. So I think that there is always a space in the market. But I think that the internet is like a toddler, isn't it? Well, those of us who use it all the time, social media is like a toddler. Whereas my husband, who has always been an early adopter of all technologies, he has been, you know, in chat rooms and forums and things for decades, and people used to be massive dickheads in them, and now
people are MPs. And it's coming back to bite them on the ass.
But now that evolved, and now he's in like computer game forums where they are properly monitored and managed, and people are nice to each other. Like he went to meet some of the people that he is in an internet forum with at Christmas one time, and I thought, because of my experience, that he was never coming back. It's like they're going to kill you, because people you don't know on the internet, that's what they do, they kill you. And he came back and they do a little Secret Santa and stuff, and it's like, but, and there's thousands of people in it and everybody gets given a name. So there is, I just think we're at the toddler phase of political Twitter, and maybe it will evolve to be better.
No, I agree, and I think that, you know, things are going to keep on changing. So I think something that's especially like is going to be interesting, so like watching what happens, is people's internet long-term history. Of we've had that with like Jared O'Mara, who I guess was a slightly different case because some of the messages he posted online were quite recent. But, you know, just the idea of like all these council candidates or whatever who said something offensive in 2012, which apparently now means that, you know, they probably can't be in politics, or can they? We're not sure, and the line is quite grey. And I'm not entirely sure how we're going to deal with that, because again, I think it's such a new problem in politics to be like, oh, suddenly, you know, every stupid thing anyone has ever said is somewhere online and we can still see it. And we're not, I think that's one of the things as well, we're still learning how to deal with that, how to manage it.
Yeah, and the Jared O'Mara thing is an odd thing. I mean, I get angry on the internet, but it doesn't make me massive sexist or homophobe as a rule. The Gerard O'Mara thing I also found to be absolutely fascinating, that people wanted to insist that he was young and this was what would happen to young people and we should all take, you know, Gerard O'Mara is, I think, 3 weeks younger than me. So I'm not sure that held much water. I have no sympathy for Gerard O'Mara and what he wrote on the internet. I don't let my son have any social media, and not because I'm worried that people will threaten him or do anything to him. I am worried how he will feel if he says some stupid thing, and he says some stupid things all the time, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about half the time, and then it's in the newspapers that he said this stupid thing, and they would try and pin that on me. And it's not me that it bothers, but how he would feel if he thought he'd caused me trouble. So trying to teach them that it's indelible and they won't go away is hard, I think.
But again, I think I'm really interested in the grey area as well, where, like, because you know how Facebook has this, like, on this day feature, and I do check it quite often, and there's, I can't remember what it was now, but I did say something that was, like, made a pretty sort of, like, tasteless joke, and so that's when I was 18, so I obviously saw that, deleted it, you know, it's gone forever now, which is why I can talk about it on this podcast. And there's a bit like, well, shit, actually, if that'd been found, like, I'm not sure how people would have reacted, because 18, you know, I was an adult, but also clearly, while back, you know, I'm not the person I was at the time. And so I'm not sure how we're going to decide. Like, I'm guessing it's going to be a case by case thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, how do you decide that person was definitely young enough, that person was, you know, should have known better, or it's been, you know, it's been 7 years, so it's fine, or it's been 5 years, so it's not fine enough?
And I suppose it's how you've changed and how you've shown that your attitudes have changed in your actions, which, if you're a public figure, is easier to show than if you're just, like, you know, Ben, who works down the Texaco garage, and they find something off colour that he said, and so he doesn't get a job. He can't really prove he's changed. So it's definitely going to be coming up more and more.
I had some pretty strong feelings about X-Files episodes when I was 16 or 17.
Did you?
And fortunately, they haven't come back to haunt me, but I do fear it's only a matter of time.
In the next episode of Polling Politics.
There wasn't really the internet when I was 16 or 17. We had it, and we used to talk to weirdos on chat rooms at my friend Helen's house. But,
well, this will date me hugely, but it was actually on something called Usenet, which is... let's not go there. Anyway, let's end on a more positive note when it comes to this. Give me an example of the best tweet you've received.
I really genuinely laugh out loud at things that people say to me on Twitter all the time, which is why I stay on it, because it is an opportunity for people to be whip smart. But gosh, no, that's hard to think of an example.
Nominate Leconte.
I think the funniest bit of trolling I got, which is sort of like, obviously kind of, you know, like trolling, but genuinely is like quite funny and sweet, was so this guy got in touch a few months ago and like DM'd me, didn't follow me or anything, and was like, hey, I've got you know, you're a journalist, I've got a scoop, I've got a big scoop and I'd like to share with you. Saw that and I was like, definitely, you know, there's definitely not a story in there, but you never know. Yeah. So, you know, I replied the classic thing of being like, hi, thanks for getting in touch, we can talk here, here's my email if you want to talk there, blah blah blah. Entirely predictably, he just sent me a massive high res picture of a scoop of ice cream. You know what? I replied, is that a fair play?
Oh,
that's,
I thought,
like,
you were
really
going to say
funny.
He sent you a dick pic. And no. So I'm so thrilled that it was ice cream. That is genuinely funny.
It was just a scoop of, like, a big scoop
turns
of ice cream.
Turns out once the ice cream melted, it was his dick.
Oh, gosh. I just think that's so brilliant. I love that man.
And I did say, it was like, fair play. Like, that was very funny. And he was like, oh, well, glad you liked it. And, you know, that was that. I enjoyed that.
Oh, that's brilliant.
That is very sweet. Marie, who's going to win the World Cup?
Well, I think we all know that it's... oh God, I can't even bring myself to do it anymore. Morocco will win the World Cup, obviously. Yeah.
Morocco.
I mean,
is
we
that
have
obvious?
Lost we have lost against Iran, and the other two teams in the group are Portugal and Spain.
I mean,
right, so
it's looking good for Morocco.
but yeah, oh my God, like, my favourite Moroccan magazine actually published a piece like a few days ago, entirely serious, going... three scenarios in which Morocco can still make it out to the group stage. It's like, oh, guys.
Well, your self-belief in Morocco is replicated somewhat among people from Morocco.
Well, that's a shocker.
Over one in five people from Morocco believe that Morocco will win. Now, this, of course, was conducted before the start of the tournament. Now that things have begun, it's clear that England will win after their victory last time. But it's just over 1 in 20 English football fans thinks they're going to win. Jess, who do you think is going
to
win?
I just don't care, really. I mean, I would like England to win, obviously, because I don't want to talk down England, but mainly because I got them in Stella Creasy's sweepstake.
Is this organised on WhatsApp as well?
No, it's actually it does have a really specific WhatsApp group, and I got England in the draw. But there's prizes for not just winning as well, like worst goal, best goal, that sort of thing. But I don't know, and I can't say I'll be watching any of it, I'm afraid to say. I don't mean to talk Britain down, but, you know, I mean, Asda was lovely and quiet yesterday.
Well, you're not talking Britain down because Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland didn't qualify.
Okay. Well, I mean, you've just talked them down.
Yeah. Just pointing that out.
I shan't be watching it. My husband doesn't watch football and neither do my kids, so I doubt I'll be watching much of it.
Well, Germany were the pre-tournament favourites among 11 different nations that were surveyed. Nearly a quarter of people thought they would win. And then they went to lose their first game as well.
So against who?
Mexico.
Mexico. I think Belgium might win. I only think that because Anna Turley knows about football. Anna Turley, the MP for Redcar, she knows about football and she said her hot tip was Belgium.
Jess, thank you very much for spending time with us here at Delta Pole Towers. Unfortunately, there was no time for our interview with Gareth Southgate. Jess, the book is Every Woman, One Woman's Truth About Speaking the Truth, available from all good bookshops, and we have 5 copies to give away.
And the only thing you have to do to win a copy is to tweet us at PollingPod and tell us about your favourite sort of like badass feminist role model.
And if you don't want to know the football results, please look away now. Thanks.
I feel really liberated as a politician to admit that I don't watch football and I don't care.
Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled PODOTPODS.com.